This is the business of Africa. If it's about Africa, then it's our business, bringing big and small business issues right to your doorstep. Hear ye, hear ye. We are fully into the fourth and last quarter of 2025. And boy, what a ride it has been. If you have made it this far, take a breath, pause. There's a lot to be grateful for. Hello and welcome to the Business of Africa. My name is Duduzile Ramela, and it's such a pleasure to be in your company. On this episode, we meet the Business of Africa, our regular feature where we profile entrepreneurs who have broken free from the mold, if you will. Joining us from the heart of Africa is agripreneur Nohemi Mawaka, founder of Lubembo Corp, a consumer goods brand that supplies premium raw honey. Thank you very much, Nohemi, for your time on the Business of Africa podcast. I must admit, I was incredibly excited to speak to you. One, because I've learned so much from you and we haven't even met yet. But two, I love the Democratic Republic of Congo. I look forward to recording this episode again, and this time with cameras in tow, so we can show our audience the wonderful work that you do. Welcome and thank you once again for joining us. Where did it start for you?
Ooh, that's a loaded question. So I'm native born in DRC, which is where I am right now. I'm actually my childhood home where I was born. Now I'm 34 and I was raised in Canada. I immigrated to Canada super young. So during COVID, I moved to San Diego when I was working in tech. So while I was in San Diego, my dad was sending me artisan Congolese honey from his original land, rural setting, what we call village, in Bandundu, DRC. And I was selling it really just online, Instagram, farmers markets in the US, and I kept running out of stock. So then I asked my dad, I was like, okay, you're sending me like 20, 30 kilos. That's nothing. Like, sure, these American retailers are asking for like 2 tons, 3 tons a month. And my dad was like, okay, you need to be realistic here. Like, these farmers don't even have electricity, let alone roads. Ooh. So they're doing honey production in the artisan manner, traditional manner, not with hives. So then the tech company I was working for in Silicon Valley went bankrupt, which in America, that just means CEOs are profiting. So I took my sovereign package. I moved back to Congo. I bought massive land with my dad in our village, which is what we have today, where we actually have a honey plantation site where we collaborate with local cooperatives, informal or formal. We train them on beekeeping, and then we buy their goods at market price, which we set for export. And then the second part of our business, which is the biggest part, we find buyers in the Western market, preferably US and Arabic countries, and we negotiate pricing. And then we sort of are sitting in the middle. And so with that being said, given the global demand for honey, Congo, realistically speaking, because of its constraint and challenges with infrastructure, customs, we've had to expand to countries like Kenya as well. So honey is really our first baby, and then we added botanicals like moringa, hibiscus, and baobab to the mix. But really, that's how it really started. I just saw a product market fit. The U.S. has a shortage of honey, 40 cents a person. African honey is organic, it's non-processed, and there's this wave of healthy foods that's needed. Arabic countries value honey, especially when it's organic. It's cultural for them. And so I just saw this as a market opportunity, and our farmers in Africa, they produce stuff, but they don't produce it commercially. They don't have the tools, the know-how, and they don't have the language to negotiate pricing with foreign buyers. Enters Lubembo.
I love that. So that also covers why the United States and Arabic countries in terms of markets. You mentioned that at the time when your dad was saying, ma'am, your dream is too big, because they're using, or rather they're harvesting the honey in an artisan manner. Is that still the case right now? And when we say artisan manner, what does that mean?
Yeah, it totally is the case. I mean, especially for Congo and actually most of Africa, if you think about it. So artisan honey in the context of the African continent means that, I have videos and posts that I'll be posting on LinkedIn very soon to show you guys what that looks like. Mm-hmm. So what happens is it's literally as simple as you go in one, I hate the word village because it's colonial, but it's the only word I can think of. You go in one of these rural settings, right, in most of African countries, and you say to the locals, and you say, hey, if anyone has seen a hive of bees. So in Lingala, we say zoing, like it's literally bees. So what that looks like, it's literally a bunch of bees hiding inside trees or hiding under the soil. Mm-hmm. And the locals, they know, because when they're hunting for food, they're harvesting food, they find them. So what we do, we literally make that announcement, and then they notify us where they find them, and we pay them anywhere from $5 to $10 for bee colonies that they find hidden in the forest. And then we take those colonies, we put them in hives. That my hives are made in my farm because I have too many trees. We cut a tree and then we plant a tree, which we use to build a hive. But if you don't have beehives, what you do, you literally just wait for that bee colony that you found in the tree or in the soil to naturally produce honey on itself. But the problem with that, you're waiting on bees to produce their own honey. Like naturally, it could never produce one time. Whereas when you take those bees, you move them into an artificial environment like a beehive, where you have over 10 rays in one hive and then you can stack them up. You're going from a projection of, if you're lucky, 1 kilo to well over 30 kilos in one hive. So imagine, and then hives, you can place a hive 10 meters in between hives. And my farm, I have well over 3,000 hectares. So you can imagine how you're going from 1 kilo, if you're lucky, because you're waiting for this bee to produce on its own, to now 30 kilos in one hive, because you've moved it to an artificial setting, which is a beehive.
This is such a did you know moment for me, because I did not know that you can find a beehive in the soil. And so you mentioned the word, is it zoing? And you said it's in your native language. Is it, please help me,
Lingala.
Lingala. Yes, thank
Lingala.
you.
And I'm butchering it. I think it's like it's Zongi. I'm butchering it, but
Ah,
that's
okay.
Lingala.
As magical as this all sounds, how do you move your goods from one market to another, especially when we look at the different continents? One cannot imagine that it would be, one, easy, two, a cheap exercise, more so when we speak of compliance.
Yeah, I think it's very complex, but I think with anything in life, I think this is where being an entrepreneur and the luxury that I've had is studying my entrepreneur journey in the West. But to be fair, my entrepreneur journey started when I was like 13, 14 in Congo. But I always moved between markets. I was always either Canada, Congo, US, Congo, something. So I had exposure to both markets quite early. But there's pros and cons of the West. The West, the pros is that there's processes, there's structure, right? So once you understand processes and structure of the Western market, you know how to move it. Whereas I find in African continent, especially in a place like Congo, and now I'm learning other African markets, say Nigeria or even Senegal, which is very Francophone Africa, there's a lot of bureaucracy, and a lot of that bureaucracy is just artificial. And let's be honest, there's some bribery, corruption in those systems that make it very hard for locals to even export without exacerbated costs. That being said, so how it works is actually there's a process. So when you're exporting in bulk, you're exporting in bulk. So I'll give you an example. We have really two products. We have our own honey that we sell in a jar in Western markets, but really 80% of our business that we've shifted is to become aggregators, B2B, right? So what you do is you find a buyer in the West. Say, let's take an example of a US buyer. The US buyer would tell you, we're looking for this type of honey. In our case, because it's Africa, we only provide three types of honey: dark amber, which is dark forest honey, medium amber, and a bit of light amber, which has a bit of mix with sunflower. But really, most of African honey is acacia because of the forestry. Western honey is usually made of sunflower, hence why it's usually lighter. That being said, what happens is the buyer will give you specification of what the packaging must look like, drums, so forth. If it's under a certain quantity, you have to go by air. Air freight is very expensive. So in the case of Congo, you're dealing with Turkish Airlines, which actually has reasonable price, I find. Or you're dealing with Europeans like Belgium Airlines, which is ridiculously expensive. For Air France, too expensive. Like you're just going to be out of business. So before you do that, and I think this is where I encourage Africans that want to get into the space to make use of AI, you literally go online and you ask of like, what are the costs involved, which you call FOB, right? FOB is from the farm to the port. That has to be on the farmers. And you can imagine with African farmers, we don't even have the language, the understanding. They will not know how to do those price breakdown. That's where NAFTA meant. And so then when I negotiate with buyers, I do a price. I'm like, okay, these farmers, it costs them X amount. We supply them with X hives, machinery, which cuts down a lot of their costs, but they still need to make a fair wage. But then from this location to the nearest port, it's going to be this much. From the port to get on the port, it's going to be that much. And then from the buyer's location in the West to their shelves, that's their own cost. But you put that all in the receipt, and then you ask for any between 30 to 50% deposit to cover the majority of the first cost that's on the ground in Africa. And then the rest, they pay you at the BOL, bill of lending, once they receive the merchandise is in the water. So I think, and in terms of your other question of compliance, it goes back to what I said earlier. I think for me, the advantage of having been raised and trained in the West, like my last job in Silicon Valley was in pharma and tech. So I dealt a lot with the FDA. The FDA is the Food Administration, the Drug Administration of the U.S. That was more on the pharmaceutical side, but they manage anything that's consumed by Americans. So the moment it hits U.S. port and it has to do with food, you have to be approved by the FDA. What people don't know, similar to Africa, this is where the U.S. is very similar to the African continent. You have a lot of what you call facilitators. Mm-hmm. You have a lot of third-party companies that you can pay. They do the process for you. Now, there is a cost, and this is where it kills most Africans, because that cost is anywhere from 1500 to $3,000. And so that's already a huge cost for the average person in Africa. But then the good thing about the U.S., I mean, you compare customs to import over 5 ton of honey into U.S. Miami port, customs is only going to charge you maybe $500 or $1,000. Now, the yearly fee of FDA, that's like $2,000 per year to be compliant. But to export that out of Congo, for example, that time, you're looking at a container of $25,000. So in the case of Congo, it's actually Congo has exacerbated fees for export and import because of lack of infrastructure. Kenya is cheaper. But that being said, I think it's more a matter when it comes to compliance. I think from my experience with the African continent, aggregators or farmers, I should say farmers, I think with compliance, the complex, I think, is at the production level. When you're producing honey, the Western buyer wants traceability. So when you, if you ever get the chance to come to our farm or our foundation branch, where's your independent beekeepers that are part of the cooperatives, we've actually created a manual and a module that standardizes honey production. So from the moment you become one of our members of our cooperative, even if you're informal or formal, we literally show you how to number each of your hives. We show you how to monitor the amount of bees that goes into your hive. We show you how to, the moment the honey starts producing, which is called harvest, when to document that, who is handling that hive. All that is part of the commercial production of honey, which is what the buyers want. Because once you do all that, get approved for compliance in the Western market is a breeze. And that's the legwork that's very hard for many local producers to do. And unfortunately, it gives a lot of the Western buyers too much power to just be like, well, you're not compliant, screw you, or I'm going to buy for dirt cheap because you didn't do X, Y, and Z. And they get purchase power.
On the costs, more so on the continent, that figure that you mentioned when you say it's quite expensive, and earlier on you mentioned artificial bureaucracy on the continent. Is there a way of making it better? Oof, or is this it?
No. I mean, I'm an idealist. I'm not just an optimist, but I'm an idealist. But to be an entrepreneur in general, especially in the African continent, you have to be an idealist, right? Because you're going against the grain. Mm-hmm. So you cannot be a realist, or else I would not do what I do. I think my answer is going to sound horrible and unorthodox, and I hope I don't get arrested or killed for saying this. I think I'm speaking to our generation that are coming into this market, that are coming into these industries, nuance. I think we have to work with the bureaucracy and the corruption and the dysfunction. What does that mean? I think in your cost of when you're billing the client or when you're looking at operational costs, you have to factor in for the informal fees. You have to factor in for that bureaucracy. You have to factor that into your costs and your fees. And it's unfortunate because I'll give you a very simple example of what happened recently. I'm going to give you a very basic example. There's a buyer in the U.S. that wanted to buy something like 250,000 ton of honey, which 250,000 ton of honey, just to give you a bit of a bulk price of what kind of revenue I could walk away with, would be well over $500,000 in revenue. No, in profit, actually. Sorry, in profit. When you remove the post-EBITDA, you remove the expenses. And so literally the net income of that will be close to $500,000. Now, in Congo, and what they're looking for, the DRC has way more land to produce that they need. Like Kisangani North, you're talking crazy forests that can compete now with the Amazon of Brazil. That being said, to export that kind of quantity per year will cost us well over $250,000 out of the port of DRC. Because $250,000, just to be clear, is not the official fee. The official fee for that would be like $50,000. $200,000 is going to informal fees, bureaucracy, artificially created in the DRC. That being said, then what do you do? Plan A, you find another African country like Kenya that has better policies for export, But that being said, Kenya doesn't have the land, the arable land that DRC has to meet that demand. Neither does Zambia, neither does Tanzania. B, you then work with the system. You're like, okay, how do I reduce this 250 cost? Who do I need to talk to? Who do I need to see? Who do I need to partner with so that we create some kind of contract that, listen, instead of charging me so much every single time, I'm trying to secure this buyer for a five-year contract. If you make sure that you follow the compliance of the law, which is that it really should be 50K, fine. You want to get up to 60K so you can make your 10,000, fine. But really, you need to keep it this low in order for me to secure this buyer. And then every year, you're going to get your payment. And in your payment, you're going to find your benefit. So I think, unfortunately, this is how we have to work at this time. And another thing I would add to that, and this is, again, very contrarian and maybe unorthodox. Being young and grown up, I'm a millennial. I grew up in the Western economy. I think, personally, the future of Africa is the private sector. I think we've seen enough with our governments that have shown to be weak. And those of us coming into these spaces, I truly believe you have to do the private sector approach. Dealing with the bureaucracy, governments have to play a role. The reason why DRC export fees are so high is because of the lack of infrastructure and the bureaucracy, which is really the job of a government to mitigate and monitor. But our governments throughout the continent have proven to not be able to mitigate that. So what is the solution, in my opinion? Like I said, to work, privatize this relationship with those that handle the bureaucracy. That's my solution for now.
Thank you so much for that. I completely appreciate that view. It's honest. It's the reality. And a lot of people will actually agree with you. I want to come back on to your point on the future of the continent being the private sector or looking like the private sector. But before we do that, you spoke of the commercial production process. So the ecosystem that you're currently in right now and the farmers that you work with, you also mentioned that people need the language to negotiate these prices. Right? Is this something that you also, or a skill that you are imparting onto some of the farmers? Do you find that language is a barrier? What kind of languages, or rather, what language is spoken? What is the predominant language, or is it more nuanced than that? So I guess the question here essentially is that how do we give people the language to negotiate these prices?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, what you're speaking of, is really in terms of empowerment, right? Empowerment of, in French, we say le petit peuple, the little guys. I think at this current stage, this is where Lubembo being an aggregator, it's part of our job, right? To be in the middle. But long term, you're right. The whole idea is really that in the dream world, I would not even be needed. In a dream world, I would be investing in all these farms and just be behind the scenes, right? I would not need to be in the middle of this. But I think at this current stage, it's very nuanced, because even the whole model of, like, because what we're doing here is commodity trading. The whole business of commodity trading, in my honest opinion, when you look back in history in the Gulf Arabs or the United States, and it used to be very simple, right? It used to be very simple in the sense of, like, the reality is you look at the world, where does soil produce the most resources? You have oil, you have food goods, and then you identify that. In some parts of the world, like the West, they don't have the temperature, the climate to have these resources. So let's do an equitable exchange. Now, colonization into the building. That was the beginning, you know. Oh, God bless Europeans. But literally, they saw too much. They saw too much. And they just saw that, and they're like, oh, here's these people that speak a different dialect that are very docile. Let's take advantage. And they don't know what they're doing. And so we're just going to extract, bring it back to our economies where we have capital, we have banks, we have all these systems, and let's make this exchange, aka commodity trading, very complex. That's when in the US economy, I think pre-Great Depression, the UK after the war, things like derivatives, right? Derivatives became a thing where you're seeing this whole thing of, like, you know, wheat. So if you look at the wheat tobacco that happened years ago, that's how it happened. Like, let's jack up these prices of contracts for when we buy these goods, and then by the time we actually export these goods and sell them into the shelves of the bill of lending, the price is different. We're going to make a margin and the price difference. It just became so complex. Even when I'm talking to you about this whole process of, like, you find a buyer, right? How it works, the buyer has to give us a deposit. That deposit has to cover a huge chunk of the upfront cost of when we buy the goods from the farmers, get it to the port. That process is like 3-4 months. And even the deposit is not enough to cover the majority. And these farmers live on cash. They live on day to day. You're not going to pay them what, like once the buyer is ready to pay for the bill of lading, you got to secure the money up front. So that's why we take loans, right? Rotating loans. So I believe it's harder and it's very nuanced at this stage for farmers to have that kind of language, because the field of trading has become too complex. And I think that's done on purpose, right? Anytime economic models are complex, you have to ask yourself who is winning in this complexity. And I think that's where it's too nuanced, because at its very core, this is business. At its very core, business is supply and demand. At its very core, business is about exchange. It's economics, right? You have what I want. I have the money. I'll pay you for it. You give it to me. But we've made this whole thing so complex. And I think to go back to your comment and your question too, what I do at my level to be a bit more pragmatic, I go baby steps. So with the farmers, step one right now, our focus right now, because our aggregator business is quite new. Our honey direct-to-consumer brand, that's a bit older, but the aggregator model is a bit new. But I think at this current stage, step one, the next couple years, the focus is more to get our producers in Africa. We're starting with DRC, Kenya. Definitely, I want to tap into other African markets. Get these farmers to produce in a way where they can compete with global standards, because you may want to talk to the buyers, but if what you're producing is not meeting global demand in terms of quality control, it's a lost cause. Mm-hmm. So let's get these farmers to understand the importance of producing in global to meet global standards. India has done it. Thailand has done it with rice. Like all these Latin America has done it with bananas. There's a reason. There's a science to it. Let's get these farmers to understand at the mental, the science. Once to get understand the science, let's then get them to understand pricing, because that's another thing that's very challenging with low-income population, right? In their mind, they're like, well, because you're coming from America, I need to jack up the price of my honey. Well, no. If no one is going to buy your honey, then your honey is actually quite worthless. Mm-hmm. This is where price negotiation comes in. However, if you're going to be in front of a buyer from Germany, from the UK, who's coming in and asking your moringa for like $2 a kilo, when in reality, AI will tell you that right now the commodity trading price of moringa for organic African moringa is 12 pounds sterling the kilo, you're getting cheapened out. So this is the second piece that I really want to pilot next year, is increasing AI. AI, sometimes even DeepSeek, which I love, or GPT, they even have Lingala in the AI tool now. So these farmers can actually speak to the AI tool in the local language and get basic understanding. So those are my two strategies for the next couple of years. It's standard of quality control and then maximizing the use of artificial intelligence, but at the local level, not with some complex and iPhone, but really finding tools that can really meet the local demand. That way we educate the local producers in a way that they can understand within their capacity. But to answer to your question, at this current stage, at the negotiation stage, it's too nuanced.
Okay, fair enough.
At this stage.
Yeah, fair enough. As we close the conversation, unfortunately, I wish we could have more time. You say the future of the continent is the private sector. How would you then respond to somebody who says that complex system that you have just described and all its pitfalls that is also found in the private sector, because there's a widely held view that the public sector is also corrupt, but the corruption also exists in the private sector. Is it what you say of making it transparent, making it less complex? And so what do you mean when you say that the future of the continent is the private sector?
I think what I mean by that is the beauty, just to be clear, you're right. Like, I actually think a lot of the corruption in history started in the private sector. Who are the people that influence politicians? It's the private sector. Who pays for political campaigns for presidency all over the world, including the United States? The private sector. So I definitely think, I think the private sector is even more corrupted. They're just smarter about it. But I think to answer to your comment, why do I think that is? There's a beauty about the private sector that we don't appreciate enough. And I think, love or hate the United States, that country, I think, is actually a great example of what we should follow in some ways, not in the intricacies, but in the economics of capitalism, early capitalism. Now, the U.S. is in late stage and it's not going well. But what really I mean by that is the capitalist market, by definition, in its original definition, is a decentralized market. That's why you have a free market, right? Mm-hmm. What it does is that it gives power to the individual, to the small business holder, to the producer, to produce something and to have a buyer. That exchange is a lot easier than having to deal with a corrupt government that's making you wait 12 months to sign a document, or if you're not the daughter of, you're not the son of, you know what I mean?
That
like
part.
There's a there's a level of speed that the private sector offers that a government cannot. And a government, even a government that's structured, I grew up in Canada, let me tell you. Canada's mostly a social system-ish. I repeat, ish. But it's a very government economy. The level of bureaucracy and slowness of that is why Canada today economically struggling. They have a hard time building businesses. And let's not lie to ourselves. We look in history, the capitalism businesses are where most jobs are created. The root cause of poverty is job, is income. So literally, I think this is what I mean by the future is that literally business decentralizes this market, democratization. And I think today, even with knowledge, the fact that I can talk to a farmer, a driver, my logistics driver here in Congo, the one that transports our goods to the port, he has an Android for it where he talks to AI, he talks to Gemini to pick the brain of Gemini on challenges in the middle of the road. Do you know how much that saves me in terms of time and cost? So much that he even comes up with innovative ideas. Like, we're now building a 3 depots throughout the country of Congo where locals can come and supply us honey, and we store it in the depot and they pay for that storage and then we find the buyer. That was the idea of my driver, that he had a conversation with Gemini. So to me, I'm like, and then in that whole idea, you don't have government involved. The only thing we maybe pay is that the physical depot has to pay a small amount of tax, but we're also placing depots in economic free zones, which is an initiative of like, you don't pay tax for 15 years when you have a business in that location. That was all my driver, who, by the way, does not speak French, which is the main language of Congo. And so, to me, I just think that the future of Africa has to be the private sector. And this is a bit where the U.S. model is a bit similar. Yes, the U.S. has the feds. Yes, the U.S. largest economy is the army, which is government led. But if you really look at even the army in the U.S., what is Trump funding right now? A lot of private sector drone army startups. Like Palantir, one of the biggest ones. Like, and I'm not like praising the U.S. Let's be honest. I will never do that. And I'm not saying Africa needs to copy and paste the U.S., but I just think that's really one model that we can really think of.
Gotcha.
And China has now followed that model as well economically. And I think Africa, we're lying to ourselves if we think that we can keep banging on the door of a bureaucratic public system that does not understand a capitalist model. And let's not forget, the public sector is made to consume money. The private sector is built to make money, to create money. Businesses, we create money. We don't consume money, right? That's the biggest difference. It's like we create money. We don't consume money. So I think what Africa needs right now is to create money. We need that cash to be created. And the only way to create that is the supply and demand curve that businesses offer. And on that last note, and I know we have to close out, but I also just want to add that, which is something that I think as Africans, we need to do a better job at. And I think that's why I applaud platforms like yours. And that's also why with LinkedIn, I decided to use my personal LinkedIn to share my journey, because we also need to highlight the African geniuses and brains that are succeeding at decentralizing the economy, right? Like Nigeria has many pros and cons. I think we crack on Nigeria a lot, but Nigeria, I think, is also to be applauded, where, you know, send 100%. Your kids to Harvard, but you come back to the continent. And then the advantage that I think Nigeria has over Congo is a decentralized bank system and the English language. But they use that to now build a cloud capital. It's what you call cloud capital, when you create capital in the digital space, that's really just moving barriers. Yes, there's still poverty. Yes, the oil industry is still corrupted. You're still going to have that. But there's also another capital that's being built on the cloud that's decentralizing many. And so I think that Africa, I'm a huge believer, a firm believer, that the future of Africa is the private sector. Those of us that are getting ahead of this curve, that have understood this. And for me, just to be clear, I have two business models, right? I export superfoods, which is honey, and now we have hibiscus, moringa, and baobab. And domestically in Congo, I do logistics and I do agro production of palm oil. So we're, you know what I mean? Like, and I really believe that this is how it should be, and this is the future of Africa. And those that are sticking to this model of only working in government in order to move the dial, I get it. If you wanna take corrupted money, which, you know, in this continent, it's like no other. But if you really wanna move the dial, if you really wanna build legacy businesses if you want to create jobs for the mass, if you want to empower the little guy, it's the private sector. And I'm a huge firm believer of it.
Lubembo, what does it mean?
Lubembo, I love that question. It's actually my grandpa's name. My paternal grandpa, my paternal grandpa, Coco Martin. Coco means grandpa in Lingala. Coco Martin, he was a teacher. And actually in the village where I have my farm, it's actually where my entire dad's side of the family grew up. And down the street is where my grandpa used to be a teacher. So Lubembo, it's actually my grandpa's middle name. My dad has the name. My brother Gad also has that name.
So what's
Lubembo? Was that?
Oh, okay. What's a dad in Lingala?
Lingala, I think it's more. It's that's more French influence. Papa, you just say Papa.
Okay.
From at least what I know, but yeah, that's what Lubembo means.
So to your Coco Marta and your Papa, we say thank you because Papa gave you the idea to be here. And Coco Marta literally through the generations, and long may it continue for your family. We love it. We love it. And thank you so much. You made my heart so happy right now. It's a big pleasure to have spoken to you, Noemi Mawaka, founder of Lubembo Corporation. And you can get them on LinkedIn, Instagram. And a big thank you to you for choosing the Business of Africa podcast. Do catch us again in the next fortnight, where we bring big and small business issues around the continent right to your doorstep. Bagaitshu, Pula.